We're continuing our series of Traffic Club podcasts for the Traffic Club of Chicago. And today we're engaged with Ken Erickson. Ken has been with Informa for the longest time, but now it is being acquired by IHS Markit. Ken is the Vice President Advisory and Client Advisory and Development at Informa, along with the Energy and Transportation Group. Ken, that's a little bit about what I can say in terms of your background, but there is much that we can talk about just in terms of your history and involvement, things like policy, things like transportation, the global markets of grain. Why don't you bring us up to speed just in giving us some background as to your company, where you are, how you're being involved in a marketplace that really does impact transportation markedly.
Well, thanks a lot, Dennis. Appreciate being on this podcast with the Traffic Club of Chicago, and this is a real exciting venue. Been with Informa or IHS Markit now since really 2001. And in my roles here, I've headed up our transportation analytics and then expanded it into transportation industrial energy. And then we had some rearrangement, if you will, bringing our offering to our clients that we communicate with on a daily basis globally, about 320 some clients in one way or another. We brought our material to a platform. And now we've kind of reconfigured ourselves where now I have formed our client advisory development team, where I spent lead our team of working with our clients on price risk management, looking at what's going on in the marketplace. What are some of the factors impacting the fundamental view? As we look at the world, it's got to balance out on the flow of commodities or supply, whether that's beginning stocks and production. I've got to balance out with what the demand is and then the great differences, the carrying stocks going over from one year to the next. And you're in a deficit country, you're constantly having to buy from somebody else. It's just that comparative advantage of trade. And we work with our clients on an ongoing basis because if you're in a position of having more than enough, you're in a position to have a residual amount to go into the global marketplace. But as we work with people in the marketplace, the other part I still head up is our energy and transportation and have retained that. And we remind our clients that, and we've been doing this for 43 years now, of working with clients in price risk management on a fundamental supply and demand look here from Memphis, Tennessee, understanding that you're not really trading a commodity such as corn, soybeans, beef, or energy products such as crude oil. You're really trading the freight around that. And whether it's the rolling or floating assets that we're looking at, but it's also over that infrastructure by which those assets roll or float over that we've got to look at too. Because transportation, on one hand, can be very short run in nature. The problem is it's got to work with the infrastructure that's long term in nature. And so we're having to bridge that gap, if you will, to communicate with our clients on an ongoing basis of just how important transportation and infrastructure is. And honestly, those in the transportation logistics groups within their companies, they're oftentimes the last ones that get talked to, but they're always the first ones that get blamed when something doesn't go right. And in the end, when we're talking about a snow event or ice event, flooding or whatever, those are things that just don't, you just can't levitate over those. And so we're having to bring perspective with our clients of what this means on the global basis, whether it's infrastructure investment in grain storage or cold storage or the cold chain supply logistics. There's a number of ways that we work with our clients. And in a greater context of our business, we have the IEG Vantage Group that I work and represent. We cover the whole supply chain of all these different commodities in a very channelized approach. And it's a real exciting area to be in. And now as we're part of IHS Markit, it's real exciting to work with groups like the Journal of Commerce, the Maritime and Trade Group, whether it's with the Peers Data, the Global Trade Atlas, vessel tracking, and really trying to bring real-time understanding of what's taking place in the markets, taking data, transforming it information, whether it goes into our balance tables live, so to speak, and then we're able to turn that into knowledgeable information for our clients who are truly trying to make a strategic decision or outcome for their businesses. At the end of the day, like all of us, be profitable and to maintain that going forward for your shareholders. So it's really exciting for us to work with our clients, and we've got a great team of analysts here, really, quite frankly, around the world, with research analysts in Chicago to Washington, D.C., to London, to China, and many points here in Memphis and Canada, and many points in between. So it's really exciting to come to work and be around some smart people and to be able to work with them and work with smart clients and clients with, we've got a lot of risk on the table that we get to work with every day.
You know, you suggest global, and one of the last countries you just mentioned was China. I know you were there recently. The fact is that we're dealing with communist countries. I know Russia in the past, China is big currently. And we've got some real challenges. Is there anything we should know in terms of current market conditions before we get to the infrastructure of the United States and how we're moving stuff here? Help me understand about the free market challenges that you face on a regular basis and how you then convey that to your customers.
Yeah, it's a good question. And yeah, I just was returned from Beijing here a couple of weeks ago in the buildup to their 70th anniversary as a communist regime, the longest surviving communist regime, quite frankly. And it's no easy feat as we look at communist history, political systems. But in China, it's a very paranoid sort of environment just by the number of cameras that are up everywhere in China. Every time I go back to China, there seems to be more cameras and listening devices, facial recognition, voice recognition, and other technologies that are monitoring. And not only that, the control of the communication of what its citizens see and what the world thinks their citizens are seeing. There is a big disconnect. And I think just this week, what we have two things. One, that the Chinese are going to be in the United States continuing the negotiations with the United States on the trade disputes that we have. And they're very significant issues. And quite frankly, they're issues that I think both sides of the U.S. political spectrum, if you will, have come to agreement on and have not argued too vehemently over of why it's important for us to have these going forward. It's been long overdue. And the U.S. farmers, quite frankly, and even some of our energy sector have been paying a price and sacrificing for some of these challenges with the trade negotiations. It really started in April 2018. And where we are today in this week, the NBA is being criticized because of one general manager from the Houston Rockets sent a tweet out really supporting the protesters in Hong Kong for them being able to stand up for their rights. But China, the mainland, did not like that, and in the end, called for an apology, a deletion of that tweet, as if no one in China would see that tweet, supposedly. But yet, in China, overnight here, when the commissioner of NBA said, "Look, we're going to support our general manager to have freedom of thought," and China essentially came out overnight and says, "Well, we don't think freedom of thought is a good thing to have." And so they basically said, we're not going to show preseason games. We're going to purge our systems of Houston Rockets. You cannot find it anywhere in the social media in China. So very different structures. And I think it's very emblematic of where it's them versus us and really them versus the Western world, where you don't have that. Because when I left China, I went to Japan and everything was back again. I had all the social media. I had full internet. I could communicate freely and openly. And you just see a big difference when you go to China. And look, that's their determination and that's their regime. But that puts us in a very interesting bind with these negotiations. And for us here in the United States, we think about commodities that are available to be moved and that they would historically move, say, to China. Now all of a sudden they haven't. That has caused a ripple effect in our economy and really to our transportation networks that have had to readjust, so to speak, to that. But at the same time in China, you do have the other major event taking place, which is the African swine fever, which is really impacting its hog population. And China is a very large pork consuming country, and their hog population totals about 750 million pigs on an annual basis. And you cannot take all the pigs in the rest of the world and come close to that number. It's a very, very large number. And there's reports of anywhere from 35% to 55% of their pigs have been killed because this disease, the African swine fever, has a 100% mortality rate on the pig. And if it comes into a region, they slaughter all the pigs. They just kill them. And they don't use them for meat. But what happened is that now there's a shortage of pork product in China, and they're really trying to recover from that. And that may have a longer-term impact on, say, soybean consumption in the form of soybean meal in that country than what the trade deal might do. And that's a double whammy right now, hitting especially U.S. farmers. Of course, U.S. farmers are being hit this year by late planting that took place in the spring, late harvest now. Now they're having smaller crops than what they thought otherwise. So we're in a very epic sort of situation on many fronts, what's taking place here. So this China thing, very important that we go forward and that we get it right, and that we move forward in a direction that it's not just about the United States here, quite frankly. It's really about a global situation and these negotiations that are taking place.
Well, in this country, one of the things that we're very focused on is our own infrastructure and our impact on it. How important, as a for instance, are inland waterways to U.S. agriculture and what's being moved and the volumes and from what locations and so forth? Help us to better understand if we're going to be able to move product, whether it's more or less. Help me understand the systems that you're using to be able to share on a global scale.
Yeah, and as we think about our infrastructure, you know, when you have an inadequate infrastructure, that could be, you know, leads to some sort of breakdown in the system. And certainly, Illinois is very much focused on that this year and really the next 3 years with its waterway system, as there's some major efforts to try to modernize or do some major rehabilitation of the system. And we can talk about that. But when you have an impediment to infrastructure, whether it is a waterway, it's a rail, it's a highway, you just reduce your effective transportation capacity. When you do that, you need more equipment to move the same volume, but that leads to higher freight rates. Higher freight rates lead to higher cost of manufacturing. And for farmers, really, that leads to lower farmer income. And we like to say the farmers pay for freight both ways, that when there's a problem with freight, they get it in terms of lower basis. And lower basis means they're just getting less cash for their crop. And then what happens when you have lower income, say for farmers or for businesses in general or for a manufacturer, you've just lost your level of global competitiveness. And other participants come to the market to take advantage of that. And so when we look at this here, and that's why transportation and really infrastructure is important. And when we look at agricultural exports of the United States, grain and soybean exports in particular, 60-some percent of those volumes move through the U.S. Central Gulf. So from Baton Rouge, New Orleans area, out into the world, and well over 95% of that export volume arrives in a barge coming from locking river areas or a non-locking area. So it's very important we look at that. But coal had been important, though coal has suffered really because of low natural gas prices. And then chemical movements are very important. That, you know, Chicago here and Midway, they depend on, during the winter months, dare I say it's coming, and it could come this week, right? There's a little blizzard that could show up in the western corn belt, that you'd need that magical solution to keep the plains from icing over. And a lot of that chemical arrives by barge from the center Gulf. And if you don't have an adequate system, those impacts get to be very important immediately. And that's where you see the global impact here in the United States. When you've got problems, it can hit home real fast. And so we see that in a major way. And we know from some work we've done that infrastructure is very important to the U.S. economy and really to the U.S. farmer.
How is this inland barge market structured? I mean, who owns and operates the infrastructure? How is the towboat and barge operators, how are they situated? Help me to better understand how we can use or utilize the network that's currently available.
Yeah, so there's probably about 12,000 miles of navigable waterways on the inland river system. There's about 200 and some locks and dams. Again, this is for the Mississippi River system in particular, since it really is what impacts really Illinois and Chicago. And from that, that's really owned by or operated by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which means then that they're responsible for the ongoing maintenance, the operations of the projects themselves. And those projects come in two forms. One, that you've got the locking structures and the dams. And those are really supporting navigation, flooding, and municipal water and recreation, among other things. But then there's the long-term aspects of the major rehabilitation that's got to come. But they also have to keep the channels by which the towboats and the tows of barges need to navigate through at the project width, project depth or draft, and make sure that it's an open channels across the system. And the Army Corps gets funding from two sources, one from the federal treasury through an ongoing budget, if you will, to the Army Corps. And that had been sliding or not growing or keeping up with the pace of the maintenance and the requirements of the system over time. Though in recent years, Congress has been helping out a little bit because of some special funding. There's been some issues that they faced. But then on major rehab and construction, new construction, that money really has to come from an inland waterways trust fund. And the industry, the barge operators, when they purchase fuel, they pay 29 cents a gallon or 29 cents a gallon goes into a trust fund. And then the government matches that, the federal government, to pay for that major rehab and new construction. It's just that it's not keeping pace when we see that. So, for example, right now, there's $6.3 billion worth of major rehab and new construction that needs to be done on the inland waterways. And really, if the government were really to put that into place and really fund it and get it and finish those projects within 10 years, $6.3 billion could translate into a six-fold increase in revenues to the economy. And certainly we'd see increased volumes move on the river system, much more jobs in the economy, expanded GDP, a contribution to GDP, expanded contribution to sales, if we're expanding and making an efficient system. And really it would help make the United States more competitive with regions like South America who are catching up. And every time there's a blip in our infrastructure, other competitors catch up with the United States and start to be as or more competitive than here. And it's really about where are we going to go in the future? And our Congress really has to wake up to that and the elected officials, because meanwhile, the barge operators, they own the towboats, they own the barges, or they lease the barges for those who are leasing them to them. And they're saying there's 20-some thousand barges in the river system, whether it's a liquid barge, covered hopper barge, or an open barge. And there's some, I think it's, if I remember correctly, 10,000 towboat units out there to move all this equipment around the system. There's billions of dollars of investment that barge owners and operators are having to make decisions on of where they want to invest, how much they want to invest, whether it's in new equipment, new engines, safety features. But if this system's not going to be modernized, it puts them in a tough spot to say, where do I want to make the investment? Because meanwhile, we do have product to move to markets. We have an economy to support in the United States. And it's very challenging. We have a lot of efforts around this, because if we don't make investments, say we reduce our investment, we could see farmers losing market output of $58 billion. But if we make the investment in the waterway system in particular, we could see a gain of $39 billion in their market value for their crops that they have. So we're talking almost $100 billion shift just by a $6.3 billion increase of taking care of what has largely outperformed itself. I mean, we're talking just not stitches and Band-Aids. We're talking knee replacements, hip replacements on our navigation system. I mean, we're talking on the Illinois Waterway, those projects, those locks and dams are some 80 years and older. Let's just think that through. If you do no maintenance or no major rehab to your own house, what happens to that house over 80 years? Well, there's a lot of problems that we have, and we've got a lot of work to be done. But $6.3 billion in our big budget is pretty small when you look at the returns we get for that.
You know, in you all did, IHS Market, prepared a study for the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the Army Corps of Engineers. There were some takeaways. What were those takeaways, and how is U.S. competitiveness being impacted that in terms of, well, I guess what we need to do next?
Yeah, you know, as we look at it, if we just keep the status quo out, say, to 2045, and we just do some basic routine maintenance, say, over that time, we'll have employment of 395,000 jobs, a contribution to gross domestic product of $185 billion in sales, output that we'd contribute to that about $354 billion. But if we do nothing and we actually decrease the amount of investment, not to the full breaking point, but just, you know, it just takes longer to move through the system, takes longer to go through the locks and such, you're going to see employment drop 18%, contribution to GDP fall 38%, and contribution to sales drop by 38% as well. Those are big drops, because if we make that investment of $6.3 billion for all the various locks on the inland river system, and in fact, if we were to dredge the lower Mississippi River from Baton Rouge to out to the Gulf of Mexico 5 feet deeper to 50 feet, and all that together, we could see actually that employment would go up 20%, the contribution to GDP up 39%, and really the output, the contribution to sales would increase 40%. What you really see is a very significant opportunity, and quite frankly, what we'd see is that our farm product volumes that would move on the river system would increase from 161 million tons, increase 35% to nearly 20 million tons that you would see moving on the inland river system. But the fact of the matter is, when we make no investment and we fall behind, we could see that our costs are going to be much higher than what South America could do to land into Asia over the United States. And we'd see that we'd be 2 to 5% more expensive if we did nothing. But if we make the investment, we could see our costs, landed costs, fall 4% from where they are today. And we could help stem the or slow the tide of falling competitiveness with South America and maintain that going forward here. But it's very important, because at the end of the day, around the world, buyers are looking for the lowest cost and the best service they can get. And if they can't rely on a infrastructure or transportation system and get the lowest price, they'll find the next person to do that. And we can tell you this much. We have a full 40-some person team in South America that study this very closely, that South America is picking up the pace and making the investment to be a supplier to the world and being competitive to do it.
Ken, you bring lots of information to us. The statistical backup is pretty amazing. IHS Market has been known for that for years. Certainly the Journal of Commerce has talked about it forever and ever. The reality is that infrastructure matters, and transportation really is a huge opportunity for us in not only the domestic market, but certainly the global markets. And it is international markets that feed the world, and so obviously very, very important. You guys are playing an important role, and it is appreciated. So let me simply say thank you to Ken Erickson. Ken, is there a way that our members, Traffic Club of Chicago members, can connect with you, can contact you should they have questions that go a little deeper?
Yeah, they certainly can. I'll give out my phone number, which is 901-766-4463. But it can also go to, on our transportation side, we have a number of offerings. We have a transportation channel that covers all the modes of transportation. We look at the flow of commodities. We look at the shoreside infrastructure and the floating, rolling assets that need to be available for the marketplace. But we publish three reports annually, a barge fleet profile, which is a survey of the barge operators and how many barges they had in operation by year of build. We also have a barge commodity profile report, which is really a companion report to the barge fleet profile, which we show the volumes moving by barge type. We develop our own supply and demand tables by barge type, and then we put together some barge pressure indices, essentially capacity utilization levels. And both those reports are available through bargefleet.com. And we also have a semi-annual inland fact book, which is a five-year outlook of the barge market. But we look at the drivers for demand. We look at what's the retirement schedule for the fleet look like? What does new builds need to be? And we put that together to give a perspective and view. But we also address the towboat market, look at the fleets around there, the types of engines being deployed, and any kind of regulations impacting the industry. And again, all of that's available through bargefleet.com. And my contact information is there along with my email address as well. But we also have a couple of events coming up. We co-host an annual waterway symposium. It'll be at the 16th annual event this year. We have the leaders of the industry together in one room. Last year, I believe we were in Chicago last year. This year, we'll be in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and we'll be there November 6th to the 8th. And we can get information from bargefleet.com. And of course, as you referenced, Journal of Commerce, a great company, a sister company of ours, they'll have the annual Inland Distribution Conference, October 21st, 23rd in Chicago, Illinois. That'll be a great venue for the Traffic Club to participate and engage with them, with one another and others from the industry or from around the world.
Ken, we're appreciative for your insight and grateful for your time today. We will be encouraging our members to participate at the Inland Distribution Conference. In fact, we have a special rate that is being offered to Traffic Club of Chicago members. So again, thank you for what you've done for us through this podcast. Your information is great to have, and we are looking forward to hearing more as we should know more going forward. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Dennis, and I welcome this opportunity and look for future times with you in the future.